und herzlich willkommen. Hello and welcome to History and Politics, the Körber Stiftung's podcast that deals with the question of how and why history shapes the present. My name is Florian Bigge and I would like to warmly welcome Katja Heuer and Oliver Moody, who are hosting our special podcast series. 2 weeks ago, we started season number 2 of The New Germany. In this second episode, we are very pleased to have Norbert Röttgen as our guest, member of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the German Bundestag. But now, over to you, Katja and Oliver, let's get started.
Hello and welcome to The New Germany, a podcast project from the Körber Stiftung's History and Politics podcast. My name is Katja Heuer and I'm a German historian and writer living in southern England.
And I'm Oliver Moody, the Sancho Panza to Katja's Don Quixote.
More like a Falstaff to my Prince Hal.
Or, if I'm honest, maybe just the loyal but faintly dim Wagner to your Faust. I'm also a British journalist based in Berlin. The idea behind this series is pretty straightforward. The Russian invasion of Ukraine has been a moment of truth for Germany, overturning what had once been solid pillars of its foreign policy, its economic model, its military doctrines.
Germany had military doctrines?
Well, a cynic might say it had doctrines on warfare in much the same way the Vatican has doctrines on contraception.
Moving swiftly on, what we're aiming for in this podcast is to look at some of the big dilemmas that are now facing Germany and explore them against the backdrop of its modern history, to look at how Germany got into these situations in order to understand how it might move forward, with help from leading experts and policymakers. In the pilot episodes last year, we talked about Germany's ties to Russia, its armed forces, its energy supply, and its relationship with its own history. If you haven't listened to them already, you can just scroll back a little bit through the Körber History and Politics feed or search in your podcast app for The New Germany. In this new series of fortnightly episodes, we'll be addressing subjects from Germany's place in Europe and its peculiar aversion to strategic planning, to its atavistic horror of debt and the changes sweeping through its political parties.
But today, there is a topic so central to Germany's future and so emblematic of everything we've been talking about that it can no longer be ignored.
Gender-neutral language.
Nope.
Winnetou.
Nope. It's China. Germany's largest trading partner. Its most significant source of tension with the US and, in the eyes of some analysts, a case where it's in danger of making many of the same mistakes it made with Russia, but this time with bells on. Let's start with the recent news that Bosch, the German engineering champion and manufacturer of washing machines, power drills and once upon a time of Wehrmacht tank electronics, is investing nearly €1 billion in upgrading its high-tech facilities in Shanghai and the neighbouring city of Suzhou. What caught my eye about the press release was the way the company trumpeted the fact it had been active in China for 110 years. Obviously, this was intended to inspire a degree of confidence in its thorough knowledge of the Chinese market, but it does raise the awkward question of what exactly German companies were up to in China 110 years ago. And this seems like a pretty good starting point for talking about Germany's approach to the whole thing.
Okay, go on.
Well, let's actually begin a decade earlier than that, in 1900, when Kaiser Wilhelm II goes to the port of Bremerhaven, stands in front of the German Empire's East Asian Expeditionary Corps, who are about to sail to China and take revenge for the murder of the German envoy, and delivers one of his famous splurges of impromptu soapbox oratory. Are you going to do the Kaiser Wilhelm voice here, Katja, or shall I do it?
Oh, let me do it. I'm going to put on my best German accent. Wait, I've already got one. So let's go with that. Just as 1,000 years ago, the Huns under their King Attila made a name for themselves, one that even today makes them seem mighty in history and legend, so may the name Germany be affirmed by you in such a way in China that no Chinese will ever again dare to look cross-eyed at a German.
That's almost Churchillian, Katja. It's like shivers down my...
or Wilhelmian, rather.
Shivers down my ancestral British spine. That was, of course, Kaiser Wilhelm's infamous Hun speech, an absolute gift to Allied propagandists in the two world wars. But so we're taking a quick look at the context. So Katja, what were those German forces up to in China? And what kind of presence did the German Empire set up there afterwards? And what was its legacy?
A big fan of context, obviously, as all of us historians are. Well, the so-called Boxer Rebellion had been underway for some time. So this is basically a movement against Western influences, including colonialism, but also the Christian religion in China. And this came to a head in the spring of 1900 when Christian churches were attacked by this movement, as well as various sort of foreign establishments in the big cities, including Beijing itself, where the business quarter was occupied by the Boxer Rebellion, train lines cut off and so on and so forth. So people were beginning to panic a little bit. And then, as you mentioned earlier, a German diplomat was attacked. This happened on the 20th of June, 1900, a man called Clemens von Ketteler, and he was shot dead in Beijing. And this sparked outrage in the sort of pro-colonialist and community in Germany. And there was a kind of call to do something about it. In addition, the Brits were obviously there as well and were also trying to sort of regain control but failed. And so an international coalition, basically, of all the nations, foreign nations that had an interest in keeping kind of control of China and keeping a foot in China, rallied together. And this included Germany, and the rest is history, as they say in a different podcast. 7 days later, Wilhelm delivered the speech that I just somewhat awkwardly recited, and sent off his troops. And this then led to an establishment of a sort of German base in China, which is quite interesting. It's the Kiaochu Bay leased territory, which they leased, or had already started leasing really 2 years earlier, but reconfirmed for 99 years. It's kind of like what Britain did in Hong Kong. That was the sort of role model for that. And so you ended up really with this kind of German colony in China, which was supposed to be somewhat of a sort of model colony and received a lot of media attention in Germany as well, and triggered all sorts of kind of evocative notions of what people reckoned, you know, the exotic East was like. And then it really sparked a lot of kind of literature around that, and also travel, you know, travelogues and things like that, where Germany became quite obsessed collectively with the idea of China as a kind of location, not only for its trade and its economic interests, but also kind of from an evocative point of view. And that was only held on to, though, until the First World War. In 1914, it was lost to a Japanese occupation and then obviously not retained afterwards, when Germany had to give up all of its colonies at the end of the First World War.
And given that this speech of Kaiser Wilhelm's caused such a stir that the term Hun was attached to Germany for half a century afterwards, at least by generations of British schoolboys, do you have a sense of how Wilhelm and the Imperial Germans from this period are remembered in China today? Is it all just sort of water under the bridge, or are there any hints of lingering resentment?
It's a really strange relationship in many ways, because this colony that was set up was meant to be a model colony. It was kind of run with an eye to being kind of presentable, and therefore a lot of money was invested in infrastructure, and also in sort of working together with sort of local tradesmen and people like that. So in many ways, it isn't actually seen as an incredibly kind of dark period in Chinese history, certainly not in terms of the German colony specifically. On top of that, I think people's memories are always quite short. And because Germany left, you know, effectively was made to leave in 1914, as opposed to, say, Hong Kong, you know, which is still an issue, a political issue today, I think people have also forgotten the kind of resentment that, for instance, the Boxer Rebellion was triggered by, you know, towards German occupation and foreign occupation in general. I think on top of that, you also have this kind of shift, obviously, later to communist China, which doesn't really necessarily look back on these events in the same way, because there's less continuity there. And the British involvement, for example, spans both of these periods, whereas Germany doesn't. So in many ways, there is, I think, more of a break there. And then, of course, you've got successful sort of business ventures that came out of that, like the Tsingtao Brewery, for example, to use a seemingly a bit more lackadaisical example there. But it's an interesting one, because it was founded in 1903 by German settlers and is now apparently the second most consumed beer globally, which is interesting. So that in itself, you know, has a bit of German legacy there, in a cultural and economic sense, that isn't necessarily seen as a bad thing.
It's a bit of a slap in the face for Paulaner and Kronbacher, isn't it? China and Germany ultimately wound up on opposing sides in the First World War, although they didn't actually fight each other. And then I think it's reasonable to describe China as a bit of a warlord-ridden basket case in the decade after the war. And then in the late 1920s, the Kuomintang and their leader, the Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek, more or less got a grip on the country. And Chiang Kai-shek was fascinated by Germany. He regarded Bismarck's unification of the country half a century earlier as a kind of template. He admired German industry, and he hired as one of his closest advisors a former German army officer called Max Bauer, who had not only been in charge of munitions under Hindenburg and Ludendorff, but also tried to topple the Weimar Republic's government in the 1920 Kapp Putsch. And the relationship really took off after Hitler rose to power in 1933. Nazi Germany helped China to set up a domestic arms industry. It built tens of thousands of miles of Chinese railways and lent the Kuomintang 100 million Reichsmarks to fund its industrialization program. And Chiang actually sent his adopted son, Chiang Wai-kuo, to study German military doctrines in Munich. And in the end, he joined the Wehrmacht and commanded a panzer unit during the annexation of Austria in 1938. And then the Chinese armed forces were also trained under the beady eyes of yet more former Reichswehr generals, in particular the wonderfully named Alexander Ernst Alfred Hermann Freiherr von Falkenhausen, who, ironically enough, drew up a strategy for Chiang Kai-shek to fight off a Japanese invasion. And obviously the reason that is ironic is that Japan was an ally of the Third Reich and ended up driving a coach and horses through the German-Chinese relationship when it attacked China in 1937. So that is that bit of unsavoury history. Do you see any meaningful parallels to the present here, aside from this infusion of German technical expertise and industrial might into a rapidly expanding and modernising Chinese economy?
Well, that in itself sounds pretty significant to me. But yes, on top of that, I think the sort of big themes that, or big strands, if you will, that go through the relationship of Germany and China, I think are all set in motion at that time. I mean, you have, for instance, from the beginning, like this German obsession with opening up China. You know, there's this kind of perception that China is kind of an isolated but huge and potentially very powerful market on the economic side, but also a partner in the region. And that in itself, I find is something that you find that phrase all the way through, basically, from the early colonialists around the 1900 mark to now, where people are still talking about opening up China to, you know, to German investors and German politics and German influence. Then, of course, you got an economic dimension to that, given how dependent the German economy is on A, exports, and B, on the import of sort of raw materials and things that it just doesn't have at home to produce the things that it then goes on selling. China is an ideal place for both. And I think this was also realized quite early on, and it's something that you see developing in the early 20th century, not least, you know, for instance, with the colonies around the 1900 period, where the idea is basically to have a trading point there, somewhere to station navy, somewhere to trade from. But on top of that, there's also the idea that you can import and export things via this sort of route. So I would say that China has remained on Germany's radar throughout the entire time, and that the actual concepts that underpin this haven't changed all that much.
And then the relationship goes into a rough patch through the next few decades as China and Germany are enemies in the Second World War. And then after 1945, China has another bout of civil war, once again with German military advisors on both sides. This really is a period when every self-respecting warlord feels he has to have some sort of one-eyed Prussian colonel feeding him random bits of Clausewitz, right?
Well, name me a period or a place when that wasn't the case. it's an interesting period that immediately straight after the Second World War in particular, when you basically have two Germanys and therefore two China policies. And intriguingly, both of these Germanys, East and West, and the People's Republic of China were all founded in the same year, in 1949. East Germany and China actually just a week apart on the first and the... So East Germany was founded on the 7th of October, 1949, and China a week earlier on the 1st. And that meant that all of these, there wasn't kind of like a ready-made model yet that these states could adopt in terms of their relationship with one another. It was all a blank slate at this point. But of course, given that the People's Republic of China had problems, as did East Germany, being recognized as a proper state, because both were seen as the kind of split-off state that had somehow usurped its way to existing. And therefore, the two of them simply acknowledged one another and recognized one another as states right from the beginning in 1949. And this in turn caused issues, because at that point, West Germany had a policy that any state that recognized East Germany would not be dealing with West Germany in terms of a diplomatic relationship or trade. And therefore, West Germany was not overly keen to start with, to sort of establish any links to communist China. But all of that changed when China and the USSR fell out in 1960, mostly over China's dealings with the US. And this made the relationship with the GDR, with East Germany, very difficult, simply because the GDR had its loyalties to the USSR. And then obviously, if it had maintained strong links to China when those two fell out, that would have been difficult. But the West German state picked up its kind of China flirtations from yesteryear again. And at the same time, this came at a period where China was interested in kind of building links to the West as a kind of more lucrative partner than the Eastern Bloc. And so basically, they're sort of tentative links beginning to develop at this point. And China is, yeah, sort of slowly becoming a trading partner for West Germany. It's interesting, though, that even all the way up to 1969, the then Chancellor Kurt Georg Kiesinger still spoke of a terrible communist world power from Vladivostok to all the way up to our borders. All I can say is China, China, China. So there was obviously still a bit of a...
It sounds like Donald Trump.
Yeah, I'm not sure Kiesinger and Trump were comparable in many other ways. But yes, in this regard, perhaps. Yeah, and then afterwards, you get an SPD, a social democratic government, coming in, and with Chancellor Willy Brandt and his so-called Ostpolitik, sort of reaching out into the Eastern Bloc, into the communist bloc, you get diplomatic relations slowly building up from the early 1970s onwards.
Small quirk of historical trivia here. Can you guess, / do you know, which figure pipped Brandt's successor Helmut Schmidt to the post and became the first West German politician to visit Chairman Mao?
Go on.
It was Franz Josef Strauß, the fabulously belligerent leader of the Bavarian CSU party and former defense minister. I'd love to have been a fly on the wall for that meeting. I just can't imagine what they found to talk about. But a few months after that, in 1975, the new-ish Chancellor, Helmut Schmidt, goes to see Mao, and they get along very well. In fact, I think in a lot of ways, Schmidt set the tone for the next five decades of Germany's courtship of Beijing. There wasn't a lot of bilateral trade immediately. You do have to remember that even by the start of the 80s, China's GDP per capita was only 3% of Germany's. But the political atmosphere between the two countries, even back then, was almost romantic. And in the years before Schmidt's death, the Chinese prime minister called him a true friend of the Chinese people. And in fact, one of Schmidt's last newspaper articles was a fawning review of Xi Jinping's book about the Chinese dream. And I think Schmidt was deeply impressed very early on by this idea that China would be the decisive global power of the future. And he concluded, long before a lot of other German leaders, that the West had to show Beijing a corresponding degree of respect and treat it as an equal. And in that sense, I think he really does kind of prefigure all four of the chancellors who came after him.
And did German reunification and the disintegration of the Soviet Union make a difference to their relationship?
Up to a point. So even before the fall of the Berlin Wall, there's a very important moment in 1985, in the early days of Helmut Kohl's chancellorship, when Volkswagen opened its first Chinese factory, and Kohl travelled all the way over to Shanghai with a delegation of German business leaders. Again, that's going to become a big trope of German China diplomacy. And Kohl predicted back then that China was about to go through what he called a century-long modernization with sort of German industry standing at the cradle as its fairy godmother. And then the Volkswagen Santana became one of the biggest status symbols in Deng Xiaoping's China and really came to epitomize its embrace of the markets. There's a bit of a hiccup in 1989, which is connected to Tiananmen Square, because Kohl felt obliged to suspend diplomatic relations and join the Western sanctions on China. But not long after that, in the early 90s, he began visiting Beijing again, I think partly because he needed good economic news that both halves of the newly reunified Germany could get behind. And I have a lovely story from this period. All my anecdotes about Helmut Kohl seem to involve food or handbags or battle tanks.
All his do.
But this is a food story. So Kohl visits Guangzhou in 1993. And one evening, he gives his Chinese minders the slip and sails off into a restaurant where he orders Cantonese goose, fried noodles with chicken, braised Chinese mushrooms, 7 other main dishes, 5 varieties of dim sum, 2 kinds of dessert, and sweet and sour pork, but with beef instead of the pork. And the poor chef is terrified because he's never made this kind of outlandish dish before. And suddenly he has to improvise for the leader of one of the planet's largest economies. And eventually Kohl gets his sweet and sour beef pork. And apparently it's still on the menu at the Panxi restaurant in Guangzhou.
Well, you can just order a Kohl, can you? You can just go up and say, I want the Kohl.
It's called the Ku Er Liu Liu, which apparently means bavette a la Helmut Kohl. in Chinese. And Die Welt says it's the only dish in China named after a foreign politician. Although how on earth you verify a statement like that, I really don't know. Then, to cut a long story short, the relationship is further intensified under the chancellorship of Gerhard Schröder, who starts going to China every year, again with German CEOs in tow. Schröder enthusiastically backs China's accession to the World Trade Organization in 2001. He actually lobbies to try and get China into the G8, and he even pressurized the EU to lift the arms embargo it had imposed on China after the 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre. And then in 2005, there is an abrupt change of tone as Germany gets its first female chancellor, Angela Merkel, who takes a strikingly feisty line on China and even sets up a meeting with the Dalai Lama. That sounds pretty brave, Katya.
Well, yes, it does. I mean, the emphasis being on sounds. I mean, you know, we've seen this from other chancellors as well. It's the rhetoric, and then actually following up on it is more difficult, as it turns out. I mean, the substance of Merkel's both rhetoric and deed ended up differing very, very little from her predecessors. She also visited China nearly every year, and that's saying something, you know, in a 16-year chancellorship. And then when Xi came to Germany for a state visit, the two actually agreed to forge a comprehensive strategic partnership between their two countries. And so taking things even further, if you will. And when Merkel left office in 2021, Xi, who's actually normally quite guarded about commenting on foreign leaders, said that he would miss his, quote, old friend. And so there's the old friend phrase again.
What Merkel left behind was a German economy that was pretty entangled and is pretty entangled with China's, and China's now obviously Germany's largest trading partner. And there are kind of four forms of potentially risky entanglement there. The one everyone talks about is the export market, where, for example, Volkswagen makes about a third of its sales, global sales in China. That gets a lot of attention. Then another one that's fairly well known is that a lot of Germany's larger manufacturing companies run facilities in China to serve the Chinese market, but also other Asian markets. There's maybe up to 200 billion euros in German investments sitting there. Conversely, the third category is Chinese investments in strategic German assets, such as the ports of Duisburg and Hamburg. But for me, the biggest one, which doesn't get talked about so much, is Germany's reliance on Chinese imports. Recently, the BDI, the Federation of German Industries, a very powerful business body, pointed out that Germany is now far more dependent on Chinese minerals than it ever was on Russian gas. This is also true in some kinds of manufactured good, particularly the solar panels and some of the wind turbine components that are supposed to power Germany's green transition. So it's a very It's a very delicately balanced moment now that geopolitical risks have been brought back into focus by the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Late last year, Olaf Scholz travelled to Beijing with a lot of pressure on him to kind of tread this delicate balance between maintaining the relationship and conveying the West's kind of common messages about trying to peel China away from Russia, about Taiwan, and about the human rights situation. And I don't know what you think, Katya, but I thought he did a pretty reasonable job of trading those two things off against each other.
Well, as per usual, I think he just said very little. That obviously, I mean, the rhetoric was of course there, but there was nothing there to commit him to any either sanctions or promises. And so, you know, it's always easy to withdraw again from these things and find a way forward, you know, reacting to things as they come up. So I just felt it was very kind of non-committal in many ways.
Now that we've got from Kaiser Wilhelm to Olaf Scholz, I think it's time to look at the years ahead with our expert witness. And appropriately enough, this conversation took place in what used to be Angela Merkel's parliamentary office in the Bundestag, with a nice view over the River Spree. And I apologise in advance if my voice is a little husky from the cold I had that day.
Well, and as there seems to be a large risk for Germans to become hooked on all things China when they think and talk about it too much, it's probably best if I excuse myself while you speak to our guest, and I will try not to build a car factory in Xinjiang in the next 15 minutes or so.
Our guest today is Norbert Röttgen, a senior MP from the Christian Democratic Union Party and one of the most thoughtful and independent-minded foreign policy experts in the Bundestag. Dr. Röttgen was elected to the German parliament in 1994 and made a name for himself as one of the wild youths who rebelled against Helmut Kohl in favour of liberalising Germany's citizenship laws. After Angela Merkel became chancellor in 2005, he served as the party's chief whip and then as the federal environment minister before chairing the Bundestag's Foreign Affairs Committee from 2014 until 2021. Shortly after the Russian attack on Ukraine last year, he published a short but sharp book called Nie wieder hilflos, literally, Never Helpless Again, in which he argued that Germany's foreign policy as a whole, and its relationship with China in particular, were in need of a thorough overhaul. Herr Röttgen, it's a great pleasure to have you on the New Germany podcast.
Well, thank you so much. The pleasure's on my side.
When Angela Merkel first became Chancellor in 2005, it initially looked as though she was going to take quite a values-driven approach towards China. Why do you think that this approach softened over the years after that? And what do you think she was trying to do with her China policy in the following year?
I would say that more and more, the assessment became stronger and crucial that China was seen as a major contribution to German economic success. And over time, there was a decision, we want this contribution and part and positive injection to German growth, economic growth. We want to have it and we want to sustain it. And I think this was then the defining assessment and view on the German-Chinese relationship. So more and more a purely economic, a trade view on China and our relationship to China.
Do you have a sense of what Angela Merkel's relationship with Xi Jinping was like on a personal level? And how have you found your own interactions with Chinese officials over the years? Have you had a taste of so-called wolf warrior diplomacy at any point?
I don't know the personal flavor and character of the relationship between Angela Merkel and Xi Jinping was. I could speculate about it because I know the one person of this relationship, but I do not want to speculate about it. For my part, I've been traveling to China for once or twice a year since I became the environment minister, the federal minister for the environment and climate. So this was in 2009, and since then I've started to travel, to talk, to communicate with Chinese interlocutors, politicians, diplomats, and so on. And if I look back to my history of a relationship and communication with China and Chinese politicians, there's an interesting point. There were many, many years when I really enjoyed and appreciated to have controversial but quite an open dialogue with Chinese interlocutors. There were dialogues and meetings which were characterized by open thinking. Of course, we knew that our systems are different, but how could we find common ground in our responsibilities to responsibly shape the future and so on? And I would say 1 or 2 years in my, so since the outbreak of the pandemic, I have not been there, of course, and 1 or 2 years before, so several years after Xi Jinping took over, the dialogue and conversation with Chinese interlocutors fundamentally changed their character. The openness has vanished. There were conversations where when I raised a question, I knew the answer, because of course I know the official answers. And this was the new character. No open dialogue, fruitless conversations. And any time you have the party functionary there writing down everything, and you can sense that your interlocutor knows he's writing down anything, so he wouldn't dare to say anything which would endanger him. And this is a great, great disappointment, because this makes conversations and dialogue really fruitless.
You were one of the first prominent MPs from your party to start publicly questioning parts of the Merkel government's China policy. Why was that, and what were the things that first began to bother you about the relationship with China?
I think the disruptive event which forced us to reassess China is the takeover of Xi Jinping. Because since Xi Jinping, China has changed and the ambition is different and the relevance of ideology has become different. I had my talks under the reign of Wen Jiabao and Hu Jintao, and I have an experience of how different then the character evolved. And you have to be realistic. Since and when China changed its idea of itself and its ambition to fundamentally change the principles of world order, which to a degree is legitimate, but they are attacking the very core of a peaceful world order, which is the reign of the rule of law. And they want to replace this principle of rule of law by the principle of power. And this, of course, then becomes dangerous. And this also, of course, changes the character and meaning of trade relations, because also trade, everything then, by China has been seen now as a serving element, an integral element in their power strategy. So even trade turns as a power instrument. Belt and Road, the major project of exporting Chinese influence and power. And so when this happened, and since we have been seeing this and were forced to see that China has a different idea of itself and pursues a different policy, I think we have to adapt to how China sees itself. And this was the starting point of my criticism, because you could clearly see the discontinuity, the challenging discontinuity in China, and the continuity, the sticking to the past, in German-Chinese policy.
Clearly, Germany's economic relationship with China is very different in some ways to what its relationship with Russia used to be, and much deeper in some ways. But to what extent do you think Germany is in danger now of making similar mistakes that it made to those that it made with Russia in the past?
Germany has made an experience in the debate and dispute in which I was heavily involved about German energy dependence from Russia. My argument was, we must not give Russia. It's absolutely okay and fine that we import gas and oil from Russia, but only to a certain degree. And we must avoid the ability of Russia to weaponize energy deliveries to Germany. And the counter argument was, no, you can't completely rely on Russia. It's their economic interest. And in the coldest days of the Cold War, they delivered oil and gas to us. So, and it's so important for our economic success and our growth. So we should do that. And we did it. And now we have made the experience that, of course, we benefited from Russian energy. But the cost was not only the price in money we paid for that, but it was also the cost that we took a risk, that we got blackmailed, and that energy became an element of pressure and blackmailing and coercive foreign policy. So now if you compare Russia to China, then you see China is the much, much, much bigger player. It's a world player with a clear and clearly communicated foreign policy strategy, aiming at increasing the influence and changing and reshaping the principles of world order. And then you assess the economic relations and dependencies, and you see clearly that the former German dependency from Russian gas and energy is a fraction of our economic dependency from China. We outsourced only energy to Russia, but we have outsourced economic growth and major parts of our economic growth and our dependency on China for the economic growth in Germany. And so this is much broader, uncomparable nearly in scale and scope. And so we should learn the lesson that, of course, you can't change course in one day. But step by step and strategically, we should engage with China. China can't be ignored. It shouldn't be ignored. But we should not agree on fundamental dependencies. We have to reduce dependency and have to work for a stronger position, which enables us to cooperate with China without agreeing to the existential risk to be economically destroyed because our dependency is so heavily and so fundamentally.
In your book, you argued that these dependencies should be systematically dismantled. That sounds like something much harder than simply finding alternative sources of things Germany relies on China for today, such as wind turbine components or rare earth metals. How might it be possible to abolish these dependencies without causing serious damage to the German economy, and especially to things like the green energy transition and large manufacturers that have placed very big bets on China?
I think the answer is that it needs time, but I think we have some time. We shouldn't waste time anyway, but we have some time. And the crucial challenge is that we start by strategically reshaping our relationship, which means that we should start by designing a relation, not only a German relationship, but a European relationship in order to get stronger. I am very much in favor of a transatlantic common position vis-a-vis China, but it's not only depending on the Europeans, also about the America of the Americans. So we have to see if we can find common ground. We should aim at finding common ground, and this should be a major topic of German foreign and economic policy to explore if there is a common ground for a transatlantic China policy, because the stronger we are, the better we would be able to cooperate with China. And then we have to make sure that we, in any case, do not increase our dependencies. So the reduction of dependency is even another topic, but we certainly should not increase dependencies. So it was an essential victory in the last term of our parliament to pass a 5G bill, which did not agree on surrendering our 5G network to China, because this would have meant to transfer to China an essential part, fundamental strategic influence on domestic affairs in Germany, and transferring it to China. So we were successful in the parliament to changing the law which was introduced by the government as inviting everybody, which would have meant Huawei would have been successful building our 5G networks. And we have changed the character of this law from a law of invitation to everybody, to Huawei at the end of the day, to a security law. So we can't do that. It was against resistance of China, but we were successful in doing so. And the third element is that we have to redesign the prospect of German economic growth by identifying and developing areas of economic growth which are not combined to political and economic dependencies. This is possible. We have to do it. So in one sentence, put it in one sentence, we have to design a new economic growth strategy which takes into account that we have to try to decrease and avoid geopolitical risks. Integration of geopolitics in our trade policy. This is what we have to do and which we can do.
A moment ago, you talked about the danger that Germany might be exposing itself to coercive foreign policy from China. I wonder, could you be a little bit more specific, please, about what kind of things Germany may be leaving itself open to? And I'd particularly like to ask about the possible collateral damage Germany could suffer if China were to make good on its threat to forcibly take over Taiwan.
So major parts of the big German industrial companies and quite a lot of German Mittelstand has put its economic growth prospects into the Chinese market. The big areas, automotive, chemical industries, pharmaceutical industries, construction industries, for them, China is an essential, really essential part of their growth strategy. 50% of the revenues of VW, VW, is dependent on China. This is a huge part of the growth of the income of this company. So if international relations are fine and peaceful, this works. As gas supply by Russia to Germany has worked for a long time. But if there were an international conflict, if China were to attack or were to do what Xi Jinping has repeatedly announced, to reunify with Taiwan by any means, which means by military means, this would lead to a global economic meltdown, and it would have a destructive impact on the German economy, in the breadth of the German economy, because nearly everybody is dependent on this. And of course, we would be forced and would be willing to pick sides in such a conflict. So we would impose sanctions on China. We couldn't stay neutral. We wouldn't and couldn't. The Americans, in any case, would make clear that there is also another relationship to the West where dependency of Germany is great. And the potential of retaliation by China would be extreme. Huge, incomparable to Russia's capacity to impose sanctions on the energy sector. So this would be disastrous and destructive for Germany. And this, I do not know if this risk materializes. Nobody knows. I would say it's not in the interest of China to create this global economic meltdown. They are economically too weak for that. They can't afford. But I don't know if it's going to happen in 5 or 10 years' time. So what we have to do, in any case, is prepare for the worst case. Prepare for what Xi Jinping has repeatedly announced he certainly is going to do. He's determined to do it. So it could happen, and we should be prepared.
The German government is expected to publish a China strategy at some point in the next few months. Olaf Scholz has been fairly emphatic already that he does not want to see the world break up into blocks centered around the US and China, or to decouple Germany's economy from China's. But how much choice does Germany actually have about this? Do you think it can ultimately maintain this position as a privileged diplomatic and trading partner to two superpowers?
I think we should avoid false and flawed alternatives. nobody, really and literally nobody, is talking about what Scholz pretends to avoid, decoupling. There is, nobody wants to decouple. I think there is no there is even not an opportunity to decouple. We are living under this circumstance of globalization, and we will continue to do so. So this is not what it is about. And on the other side, we have to be realistic on the geopolitical reality we are facing. And this means that there is no option for Germany to go it alone. It's because Germany is a medium-sized power, and we have to find our position which preserves our freedom and our sovereignty. And for this, I think we have to face and this new geopolitical reality, and sticking to the past, sustaining the rhetoric of the pre-Xi Jinping China policy, which does not take into account that there is a new China, will not yield the respect of China. It will not be tolerated by the Americans, and by this we will divide Europe. So this will end quite disastrously with Germany pursuing political Sonderwege, and we will inflict huge damage on European cohesion, the viability of the transatlantic partnership, and at the end of the day we will be too weak to counter China by having isolated our country. So we have to fundamentally reshape our position as an influential part of the West, which means not agreeing to everything what comes from Washington, but bringing our influence into a transatlantic position. However, I have not seen a signal by the Chancellor that he is willing to change course. He is very much in continuity of the old China policy, and I think this is something which will, if it's going to be pursued in this way, irrespective of everything which might be written down as a China strategy, if the reality of German-China policy will remain more or less the old style, it will be disastrous for Germany, Europe, and the transatlantic relationship.
One final question. Some foreign policy analysts have argued that Angela Merkel's China policy was the single most consequential mistake of her chancellorship. What do you think, and how do you assess Olaf Scholz's approach so far? Do you see any signs that he is willing to do things differently?
No, what I see, unfortunately, in Olaf Scholz's China policy is it's all about continuity. He's not signaling in any way any kind of changing the course. He has pushed through the Costco States Company, which is now invested in the Hamburg port, which is has a European economic relevance. So he has really pushed through this deal. He has pushed through greater economic political influence of China within Germany, and by fighting false enemies like the decoupling and other things, I think this is a rhetoric which has the aim to legitimate the continuity of old China policy. So, unfortunately, regarding Olaf Scholz, I see only continuity of the old style China policy, and by this will create fundamental doubt in Washington on the reliability of the German ally in seeing from America's eyes the most essential challenge to world order, and this is China.
Herr Röcken, many thanks for this interview. It's been fascinating.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
You've been listening to the New Germany and English language series on the Zeitenwende from the Körber Stiftung's History and Politics podcast.
To all our returning listeners, especially those who might have heard a bit of our old podcast on the British-German relationship back in the day, Tommy's and Jerry's, it's lovely to have you back.
And to our new listeners, what took you so long? But seriously though, we are thrilled to have you with us and hope you enjoyed the series. As always, we're very keen to hear what you made of this episode, so if you have any thoughts, questions, criticisms, or well-crafted Tang Dynasty-style poems about Helmut Schmidt's trips to China, please tweet them at us. My handle is at Heuer_cat.
And mine is at Oliver N. Moody. If you'd like to find out more about the Körber Stiftung, and in particular its History and Politics program, you can find its website at koerber.com. Macht's gut from Berlin, and see you next time.
Toodle-pip from Sussex.